supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, filling in for our hardworking host, Mike McGrath, as we continue with another summer special edition of You Bet Your Garden, looking back at our favorite interviews in recent years. Joining me today is our associate producer, Brett Rader. Coming up, Mike speaks with Maria Coletti, author of Terrariums, Gardens Under Glass. Maria works in the shop at the New York Botanical Garden, and what I love about this interview is that we get real tips on how to do this at home. Brett, have you ever dabbled in the exciting world of terrariums?
I have dabbled a little bit, and you'd actually be surprised how easy it is as long as you just pay attention.
Yeah, there are a lot of layers in the mix, but Maria does a nice job of explaining all that. Let's listen.
Maria, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm so thrilled to be talking with you, and thanks for inviting me.
Unless I'm mistaken, terrariums are experiencing a real surge in popularity. I see it in communications from our listeners. But you're kind of an old hand at these little gardens under glass, aren't you?
Well, yes, on both. Terrariums started slowly evolving a couple of years ago, and they have really, no pun intended, blossomed into a very interesting design-oriented craft. There are so many different types of glass vessels today, and that's one of the things I incorporate into the book. I want to share the different types of things that people can do, also with the classic terrarium, which is a closed, lidded glass container. The fact that the plants just take care of themselves is somewhat amazing, even to me after all this time.
What I'd like you to do is read us the opening lines of your book where you describe what a terrarium exactly is.
Sure. Just what is a terrarium? Well, terrariums create an enclosed ecosystem that mimics the natural world. Moisture evaporates from our soil and our plants, then condenses up into the sky or on the roofs and walls of the glass vessel or container. The condensed vapor then drops down, replicating the natural rain cycle that provides moisture for our ecosystem and keeps our planet alive. You have a little world going on inside that terrarium.
And when I think of terrarium, that's exactly what I think of. My image of a terrarium is very kind of steampunk, kind of like a Victorian conservatory in miniature with a roof that you can open and close, but that you don't need to fuss with.
That's true. And that's why I say the classic terrarium is the closed, lidded variety. These days, there are apothecary jars, cookie jars that have been used to house flour on your kitchen counter are perfect for a terrarium. And I like those a lot because they have a wide space inside. You can view the gravel and design from the outside. And once you plant that design, those plants, and water them and put the lid on, they do not need any other help.
And what's interesting is you trace the beginnings of the terrarium back to this physician in London who really wasn't trying to grow plants. He actually had a creature that many of our listeners are familiar with because it's the hornworm. It's the tobacco hornworm, the tomato hornworm. He had a chrysalis, and he was trying to get the sphinx moth to come out and put it in a bottle with some plants, right?
Very true. And either the soil or the organic matter that he had pulled into this jar included a tiny little fern seedling of some sort or a spore, and it began to grow. And even though he was a doctor, he had that scientist, botanist interest in him, and he saw this begin to grow. And I find that it's very much like myself, where you see something happening. You know, what is going on here? And the sort of excitement and joy of seeing this plant material grow without much attention. The whole concept of it taking care of itself, recycling its water inside this container, I find it exciting, and I think he did too. And that's how he discovered this terrarium idea.
Now, not all of your vessels are closed. You use all sorts of funky glass objects, giant martini glasses, like,
I do,
you know, things like that, things that are open. And is there a better name for that than a terrarium? Because to me, it's not a terrarium unless you put a sheet of glass on top.
Well, that is part of the evolution of what is going on. We have the hanging glass globes. We have some interior design magazines. They've been using cake plates and parfait dishes, but that's going off on the side. So we're talking about an open glass vessel without a lid. And what is going to happen there is my most favorite tool that I have come to use even more now with my other house plants in the house is a plastic water mister. And in a terrarium that has no drainage area, no hole like a potted plant where that's going to be able to drain out, you need to be direct, specific, and this helps you to control how you water that open terrarium. And why I'm saying all of that is because with the open terrarium, you're going to have evaporation.
Why don't you walk us through, I mean, I know there's a lot of variations you can do, but what are we putting on the bottom? Are there multiple layers of like gravel and drainage materials? And then pick a couple of your favorite plants to drop inside.
Well, you always like to put a layer of some material at the bottom, whether it be stone or wood chip, where you have a space where any excess water can fall into. So we're going to call that the drainage well. I like to use pebbles or gravel. You can use sand. And I always tell people, think about what you're putting in there because you're going to see it from the outside and you want it to be part of the look. So we put in that hardscape material. And then I like to put a divider on top. I usually use a piece of paper. It could be newspaper. Could
really?
Be printer paper. Yeah, I even have used construction paper. I trace the space inside. And the reason I do this, and some people actually use landscape fabric, the black landscape fabric. You can also use that. And what this does is it keeps the soil or the next layer of whatever you're putting on from sifting into the bottom one. So you get this clean layer, and most of your material stays out. So you've got this divider, and it's porous. Paper is porous. It's biodegradable, and so is the landscape fabric. So then you can either put another layer of hardscape if you have a big enough vessel, different shape, color, whatever, and then you put a very small layer of a foundation soil. You want to put some charcoal at this point because charcoal absorbs impurities. We put it in our water filters. We put it in our fish tanks, and it absorbs any kind of mold or fungus 100 times its own little size.
So you're biocharring.
I'm doing it. Definitely. It's sort of a safeguard.
I know you use a lot of moss, which is going to stay a certain size no matter what. But after that, the plants you choose, are the ones you're choosing plants that in nature stay small? Or like a lot of houseplants, are they going to be constrained by the size of the container and just very deliberately not grow large?
I'd say both, Mike. I speak in the book about using materials that I have had success with. So some of the smaller ferns grow very slowly. Salaginella, which is a lovely little sort of club moss fern variety of a plant. The terrarium, they will grow. They will grow slowly. We're not going to put them in direct sunlight. We're going to put them in a room with a window where they get some light. So they are going to sort of just maintain.
Are you going to water it to get it started?
What I do is I water the plants before I put them in the terrarium. I either If they're very dry, I will actually dunk them in a little water.
Oh, yeah, it's a great idea, even for when you get a bare root plant to put into your garden, is to soak it in a bucket of water for a couple of hours first.
Exactly. I will do it for a minute or two, let the little bubbles kind of go. We don't want to do it too long for the terrarium craft. Once we put it in there, we put a little more soil on top to cover that root ball. We're actually planting the plant, right, like you said, in your landscape. And that's it.
All right. Well, we could talk about this forever. Your book lists lots of resources. It is a wonderful book, a fun thing for people who don't have a lot of room but want to grow plants inside. The name of the book is Terrariums from Cool Springs Press. The author, Maria Coletti, makes terrariums at the Shop in the Garden at the New York Botanical Garden, and she joined us today from the kind auspices of the Radio Foundation in New York City. Our thanks to them and to you, Maria. Thanks for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. It was great.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone that you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring some of our most interesting interviews from past shows, selected and introduced by our producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. Coming up next, mushroom hunting and mushroom cooking, permaculture, and more. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, playing host for the day, while Mike McGrath takes a break and we listen to some of our most interesting interviews. Associate producer Brett Rader is along for the ride. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Alexis.
And Brett, I have to say that the next interview is one of my favorites because it's all about mushrooms. I love mushrooms.
Oh, so do I.
So good, right?
I've been putting them in every single dish I can imagine lately.
Well, Mike speaks with Luke Smithson and John Burkhart of the New Jersey Mycological Association, and they talk about foraging for mushrooms. But these could be dangerous, so don't do this without being very informed about what you're digging up. Brett, you're not digging up mushrooms in your backyard, are you?
No comment.
That response does not inspire confidence. Well, listen closely and don't eat any of those mushrooms you're digging up.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke, let's start with you. I'm presuming you're not only a chef who likes mushrooms and who uses local mushrooms, but you are vice president of the organization. That would seem unusual. Most chefs I know who love local food and support local farms and things like that, they're not on the boards.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was strictly into edible mushrooms, and I started trying to learn more. So I joined the association, and I really got hooked on mushrooms all the way around, and just have really kind of dived headfirst into this.
So rather than read cookbooks, you went to the people who know what's right and wrong and where to get them. And
I went right to the source. I wanted to know where to find them and what they were.
And did you get a lot of advice about using them in dishes, or were you kind of on your own after you realized, oh my God, not that one, this one?
No, in this club, there's a pretty strong tradition of mushroom cooking, and a lot of people are in the club specifically for edible mushrooms.
And is the Jamie Hollander restaurant known for mushroom dishes or mushroom-infused dishes?
At certain catering events, yes, we will definitely use a lot of mushrooms.
And is that for a special clientele?
Yes, for a special clientele.
All right, John Burkhart, field mycologist and president of the association. Are you or were you an academic in mycology, or are you just like a lifelong mushroom hound?
No, I was trained as an economist, and that's what I did for a living. And about 20 years ago, my wife decided she wanted to join this association and find out what it was about. And I discovered that I really liked being in the woods. Well, I knew I liked being in the woods. I always had. But being in the woods with a purpose of trying to find and identify mushrooms.
Now, before we go any further, before we start talking about mushroom hunting, we have to get the ground rules down, because I'm sure you guys do this all the time. Don't eat anything unless you're really trained at this or you're with somebody who really knows what they're doing that you see in the woods.
Absolutely.
Correct.
That's the first thing we tell everybody.
There are old mushroom hunters and there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old bold mushroom hunters.
You know the lingo.
Oh, yeah. You eat the wrong thing, with a fruit or a berry in the woods, and if it's toxic, it'll taste it. You'll spit it out. If you eat the wrong mushroom, the next thing you know is 3 days later, somebody else has your cornea,
Mm-hmm. Right.
How many seasons of mushrooms are there? We're in a really hot spell right now as we tape this interview. I tend to think of wild mushrooms as being spring and fall. Is that?
Well, our hunting season begins in late spring. People love to search for morels, and our collecting season begins early in May. And then there's a break. We don't do too much collecting until beginning in the end of June. And then we collect right through the end of October, visiting different parts of the state, different parks and so forth throughout the season.
So Luke, the executive chef at the Jamie Hollander restaurant in New Hope, what are your favorite local mushrooms? Which ones really work the best in dishes?
For local mushrooms, chanterelles are really the workhorse around here. In a good year like this year, we'll go into the forest and find just buckets and buckets of chanterelles growing.
Okay, so we're in the East Coast, mid-Atlantic states. What made this a good year for chanterelles?
The heat and the humidity.
Okay, so they like it hot.
They like it hot.
Well, I guess that in the mushroom farms in Redding and Kennett Square, the temperature inside those mushroom houses is intolerable.
That's what I've heard. I guess each species has their own specific growing requirements, but yeah, I hear they can be pretty hot and humid in there.
Everybody knows that, quote, morels grow at the base of old half-dead apple trees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do the chanterelles have a habitat that that when you get into this kind of a part of the woods, you might get lucky?
Sure. Yeah, these are the big old deciduous forest, the really rich humus soil. You see lots of oaks, lots of beeches. You're in good chanterelle territory.
And will they be growing in a symbiotic relationship with the tree's roots?
They are. They're what we call mycorrhizal mushrooms, and they're doing exactly that. They're in a symbiotic relationship with the trees.
Where both species benefit, both the green and the gray.
Correct. The trees are usually providing sugars to the mushrooms, and the mushrooms in return are providing nutrients that they're pulling out of the soil. So they're, in essence, extending the tree's root systems.
John, president of the Mycological Association in New Jersey. I always associate mushrooms with wood. The first thing I think of when people have mushrooms growing in a lawn is, did they bury wood trash? Did you take down a tree but leave the roots in the ground before we go into the more exotic ones that are just growing in lawns because that's their habitat? What percentage of mushrooms would you say are like have this relationship with wood? And are they more leaning towards the edible ones?
Mushrooms have three lifestyles, basically three ways to get their nutrition. One is through the mycorrhizal association that some of them have with trees. The second lifestyle of a mushroom is actually to decay wood. If we didn't have fungi...
Oh, we'd be 18 million feet deep in dead trees.
We would have, you know, thousands and thousands and millions of tons of coal sitting on top of us. Literally. They're one of the few organisms that can take the lignin out of the wood and the cellulose and allow it to return to the soil.
It's one of their main jobs, right?
So all those things that people are finding in their lawns or, you know, growing on wood chips that were brought in by a landscaper, those are basically on this planet to decay the wood and have it
and
go
bring
back
us
to the
back
earth.
Good soil to grow
have
new
it
things.
Go back to the earth, right.
So what's the third part?
The third part is that fungi can live in a parasitic relationship with plants and with animals, including humans.
Right, because we've got all sorts
of...
We've got all sorts of
fungi right in our bodies, both good and bad.
Right. So we've touched on chanterelles, we've touched on morels. What are a couple more of the edible ones?
The hen of the woods is one that we'll see in the fall.
And that's quite dramatic, right?
Yeah, that's a big gray cauliflower-like thing sitting on the base of an oak tree, usually, and, at least around us.
And isn't there another mushroom called king of the woods?
Chicken of the woods?
Chicken of the woods. Yeah, there's a hen of the woods and chicken of the woods.
Do they look similar?
No.
So the hen of the woods is very dramatic.
A dramatic cauliflower-like thing. And the chicken of the woods is going to be a yellow, bright yellow, stunningly colored, very vibrant colors.
Are they both edible?
They are.
Yeah. Two of the best.
Yeah? Really? Yeah. And if I were out in the woods and I saw a bright yellow mushroom, I would think run away.
You would think that, but these particular mushrooms, you can see them from a football field away.
I guess that does help you out,
yeah,
right?
They flag you down and you see them. But of course, there are plenty of yellow mushrooms that are poisonous too, so you need to learn your mushrooms.
So let's say you got some chicken, you got some hens. What are we doing with them? What's your first thought of how you're going to use them?
My first thought, make tacos.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mushroom tacos.
You got it.
So what else? We've got four.
We find a lot of what we in the kitchen we call porcinis, but out in the mushroom world we call boletes. We find a lot of those at this time of the year. So, yeah, those will grow in this area. We find some really good boletes around here.
So do you guys ever take field trips to other states at different times of year to go mushroom hunting? I understand up in the Pacific Northwest, it's like a dream, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What are we going to find up there that we don't find down here in the Mid-Atlantic? Or are they very common across the country?
No. Well, I think one of the big factors are the different tree species that we see, because a lot of the mushrooms that we're looking at are specific to their trees. So when we go out to the West Coast, you know, they have a whole different flora of trees and they have a whole different flora of mushrooms that are associated with them. Some are the same, but there's a lot of the mushrooms are different.
There's actually mushrooms that prefer the north and the woods of the north and mushrooms that prefer the south and the mixed hardwoods of the south. Right here in New Jersey and also in Pennsylvania and sort of this whole mid-Atlantic swath, we're in an interesting zone because we have mushrooms from both worlds.
Right, because we're kind of in the transition
zone.
We're in
that transition zone, yeah.
I know there's kits to grow mushrooms and stuff like that, and we have mushroom farms. But are there aficionados who collect spore and very deliberately go out into the woods and get mushrooms started so they can either just come and look at them or come and harvest them years later?
Yeah, that's definitely a... There's some people out there that believe that's workable. That's why a lot of people carry baskets, actual like mesh baskets, because the idea is that when you're carrying your mushrooms, the spores are falling through there and inoculating the woods. At least that's the old wives' tale of why people do that.
Oh, okay, because that's a great idea, because I'm wondering, you're a chef, Luke. Do you find a difference in wild-crafted mushrooms compared to ones you would grow from a kit or buy in even the finest market?
I think there's a difference. I definitely taste a difference, and often some of the mushrooms that I'm buying that are wild-crafted aren't available commercially, farmed, because they're just unable to be farmed. They have to be picked wild.
John, somebody with an acre or two somewhere around the country, we've always talked about mushroom kits. Do you guys ever do that, the indoor mushroom growing?
I personally have never done it, but we do have members who have become very skilled.
Because you can grow a lot of food in like a closet in your house kind
exactly.
of year round.
Right.
All you need is the right, quote, medium, which is either a drilled out tree trunk or a specific type of straw or wood chips or something, and the right spore, and you're off to the races.
Yes, we have members of our club who've been doing this for quite a while and gotten a lot of training and have a lot of experience doing it. And they will occasionally give classes to other people who are interested.
Because I should remember this more often when people tell me they're trapped in an apartment, they want to grow their own food and stuff. I should always remember that you can grow very high-quality mushrooms in a very small space, right?
Absolutely.
That's right.
So we know he's a chanterelle boy over here, the cook. What's your favorite edible mushroom?
The one that I like to eat, it's a hard choice for me. It's very close between morels, which I'm not very good at finding them, but I'm very good at eating them. And
you're supposed to be the king of the woods here. You're supposed to be, the pro from Dover.
Not with morels. I find lots of unusual mushrooms, and I sort of pride myself at being able to do that. But the morels, they always pull the leaves up over their head when I show up.
Now, what's the other one you just mentioned?
The other one I just mentioned are black trumpets.
Oh, now that sounds deadly.
It's.
I hear the ambulance sirens in the background, and my friend's going, hold on, just hold on a little bit.
We find them in the same kinds of places that we find chanterelles. And they're just these little black trumpets, just like the name implies, and they're just wonderful.
But again, we have to repeat: you really got to know what you're doing.
You do not pick these unless you know exactly what species you have. There are many of them, including the chanterelle, this one that I just mentioned. They have things that look like them.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And you have to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, we often tell people, it's the same in the insect world, the difference between a bee and a yellow jacket. Now, we just had a big thing a couple of weeks ago about how to tell the difference between a bee and a yellow jacket. And I just got an email from a guy who told me there's a species of yellow jacket that's evolved to look exactly like honeybees. They're furry. They don't have the markings. And it's like, nature is so much smarter than us. Are morels the safest mushroom, although I hesitate to use that word to find and pick? Do they have a mean sister?
There are mushrooms that look similar that you need to learn, but morels are definitely one of the easier mushrooms to learn because they're so unique.
So you guys are the president and vice president of the New Jersey Mycological Association. I presume there's an association similar to yours in every state in the union.
Several. And most states have several. Pennsylvania has several.
And is there a national organization?
There is. There's a North American Mycological Association, which they basically it's an association of all the clubs in the country, and they put on an event with foraying and lectures and workshops at a different place every year.
Yeah, because that's you got to do that.
Right.
So somebody's interested in learning how to go into the woods and identify mushrooms. And, let's face it. It's just a nice thing to be able to do. You make sure you're protected against ticks, but you go out in the woods and you maybe come home with some food, but you always see something amazing in the woods. Obviously, the first thing to do is contact your local mycological association.
Absolutely.
Luke, I'm really interested to hear that these organizations can or should, or both, attract as many people who are interested in cooking fresh food as in, just the basic science of mushrooms.
Yeah, if you're interested in learning to forage, you should really join a mushroom society to really It's where you can come and find people that have been doing this for a lifetime, and you can really pick their brains, and they can really show you the good, the bad, you know.
But what you've told me today is you're also going to meet more people who know how to cook with them than you probably thought.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a culture of eating mushrooms in our club.
All right. Our guests today were Luke Smithson, executive chef at the Jamie Hollander Restaurant and Catering in New Hope, Pennsylvania. He's vice president of the association. John Burghart, field mycologist, is president of the New Jersey Mycological Association. All right, gentlemen, thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring some of our most interesting interviews from past shows, selected and introduced by our producer, Alexis Landis, and production associate, Brett Rader. Coming up next, what the heck is hugel culture? Plus, we will try and define permaculture, biodynamic, and biointensive. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're in the stretch now. That's our engineer's favorite part, by the way. I'm producer Alexis Landis, filling in briefly for the esteemed Mike McGrath, along with our associate producer, Brett Rader. Brett, we've listened to some great stuff so far, huh?
We have. We now know how to build terrariums, and we learned the ever-important fact that eating strange mushrooms is pretty dangerous.
That sounds about right. Well, we have one more interview for you. Mike speaks with permaculturalist Paul Wheaton about hugelkultur, which is a gardening concept that replicates the natural process of decomposition that occurs on forest floors. It's really interesting, and I'm actually trying it this year with a wood stump in my yard. And if after that you're wondering what permaculture, biodynamic, and biointensive mean, Mike has the answer. Let's get started.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden, Mr. Wheaton.
Mr. McGrath, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Paul. Now, you know that permaculture is such a hot topic. It certainly is among our listeners. You get more inquiries than you can handle. Let's drop back, and I'll explain that back in the 90s, I appeared at the Bioneers Conference in San Francisco with the great Bill Mollison, and that was the first I ever heard of permaculture. He gave a talk on it. Was he the first one to popularize it in this country?
Well, he invented the word. I sure hope so.
Oh, okay.
I can't imagine who else would.
Because he was amazing.
He was. He's got that big black book, the designer's manual, which some people say is outdated, but I think it's still just as timely as ever, especially the first few pages. I mean, even if you're at the library or a bookstore, open it up and look at just the first few pages, it will transform you.
Help me understand. I don't know that I have really ever got a firm handle on permaculture. To my tiny little mind, permaculture in my landscape means things like the raspberry canes that have been growing for 30 years, maybe fruit trees. Beyond that, what are we talking about? Am I starting to get there, or am I totally wrong?
I think each permaculture person you ask is going to have a different answer to that question. And my answer is going to be, permaculture is a more symbiotic relationship with nature, so I can be even lazier.
So my system of gardening is to improve my soil a little bit more every season. I'm guessing that with permaculture, you do a lot of work up front and permanently improve your soil?
Okay, I'll go with that. That sounds nice. I think there's more to it than that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of perennial plants. A lot of perennial edibles. I mean, an apple tree, what a great example. I'm an advocate of starting that apple tree from seed and not transplanting it, because once you transplant it, you lose the taproot. And once you've lost the taproot, then that apple tree cannot get the nutrients and water that it used to be able to get from way down deep. Now, a lot of people will say an apple tree does not have a taproot, but that's just because all the apple trees they have experience with have been transplanted, which I suspect that 99.99% of the people listening to this right now, the only apple trees that they have come from transplants.
Instead of what some people may think of as simply really long-term perennials or long-term soil improvement, permaculture is everything on your property, it's starting to sound like.
Gardening is probably about a third. So the horticultural aspect of permaculture, including, you know, agricultural aspect of permaculture, is about one third.
Right.
I think a big chunk of it's going to be community, and a big chunk of it's going to be alternative energy. A big chunk is going to be natural building.
So rather than me being hung up in the culture part being horticulture, I'm thinking maybe now this is more of like establishing a permanent culture, a true culture of everything aligned.
When Bill Mollison first came up with the word permaculture, he said it was permanent agriculture. And a lot of people moved it beyond that to say permanent culture. I think for a lot of people that travel the permaculture road, they see little bits of it at first, and they keep hearing permaculture, and then they study it more and more and more. And then they drink in much, much more. And then they hit a point, and it's just a big, almost audible click. And now everything is backwards of the way you used to do everything. It's so radically different, but it all fits together. And now you only want to live your life, the rest of your life, this permaculture way.
We're going to go back to Hugel culture because obviously you and I have heard each other's names over the years. We've been aware of what we're doing in the speaking community, in the writing community, in the educational aspect of organic gardening. But what I specifically contacted you about earlier this year was Hugel culture, because we got a great question. A woman had had a big tree stump outside, and without knowing it, she defined Hugel culture, because I'm sure she had never heard of the technique, probably never heard of permaculture, but she said, I got this giant tree stump left over. They cut up the rest of the tree and took it away for firewood. Can I cover it with dirt and grow something in it? And, you know, we've had all these emails asking, will I discuss Hugel culture? And I thought, well, this woman just, you know, just drove me right to the perfect parking spot in the world to do that.
I could spend 12 hours talking about Hugel culture, and it seems like whenever I go out and I speak, that's where people have the most questions. And it's really very simple. It's soil on wood. That's it. That's Hugel culture. Thank you. Good night.
And I would like to ask people. Why is it so fascinating to people?
Well, as the wood internally rots, it's riddled with parking spaces for nutrients and water. So now, if you build your Hugel culture bed 6 or 7 feet tall, and now I know a lot of people are probably freaking out about that right now, but stick with me. The benefit is you can grow all your favorite garden plants and you don't have to irrigate. You don't have to fertilize. In fact, the promise of permaculture, for which Hugel culture plays a significant role in an urban garden where you have like a quarter acre or less, is that if you do permaculture right, then you can grow all of your food and all you have to do is harvest. You don't have to irrigate. You don't have to fertilize. You don't have to worry about pests. You don't even have to plant the seeds. All you do is harvest. And so if you have a year where you just don't feel like gardening, no problem. The garden goes on without you. The wildlife eats it all. And then if you feel like going in there and playing with it, you can get it to produce 4 times more food in like 1 weekend of playing with it. It doesn't even take very much time. The other thing is like, I'm sure that you've tasted, I'm going to go with raspberries. Let's go with raspberries. Oh. We do tomatoes, but let's go with raspberries. You've tasted raspberries where somebody has irrigated it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And
there's no taste.
What's the flavor? Yeah, no taste.
There's no taste left.
There's no flavor. And now, just speculatively, without putting on your white lab coat and getting a microscope out, what's the nutrient content of that raspberry like?
1/3 of the raspberries that I grew in my poorest, rockiest soil in a dry year without irrigation, which are flavor bombs.
So now, if we use observation skills, we can go out into the wild and find raspberries that are growing without anybody there to water them. And they're producing fruit with amazing flavor. So how rude is that they didn't, you know, you're just growing there without somebody caring for you? What do you think?
They didn't know they needed fertilizer, the stupid plants.
So every single plant that we grow has roots in growing great without anybody there to take care of it. And so it's like, well, what's the secret? What's the magic behind that? That's what we're trying to do with all of permaculture. But Hugel culture basically is an emulation of a nurse log in nature.
I think one of the things that attracts me most about Hugel culture is more people adopting it could save us from this wood mulch madness that we have here on the East Coast, where, you know, everybody gets these huge truckloads of dyed wood mulch delivered to their home, and they just coat their landscape in it, and it's the most unnatural thing possible.
I would not use woods from an urban lawn unless you know, like, the history for the last 20 years. I'm thinking about, again, it's the persistent herbicides. The trees take up the persistent herbicides.
Right. You like forest wood, right?
Yeah, forest wood is fine. That's good, especially if it's surrounded by oodles and oodles of weeds. Weeds are an indicator that there are no persistent herbicides. The weedier, the better.
Paul Wheaton, the Duke of Permaculture. Thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. What do permaculture, biodynamic, and biointensive mean? Our thoughtful question this week comes from Joe in Greenville, North Carolina, who writes, I've been looking into the different design systems I could use in establishing a new organic garden and food forest fruit orchard. I've heard about permaculture, biodynamic, and biointensive, but I'm really confused. What's the difference between these three? And finally, which do you think would give me the best view on how to design my new garden in a functional way for the long term? Well, Joe, at least two of the three you name, biodynamic and biointensive, sprang from the same source as the stripped-down style I espouse every week on this show, plain old organic gardening. No, OG doesn't have as catchy a name as the philosophies you've cited, but it is the British-American counterpart to the German biodynamic method. It evolved from the same influences as the biointensive system, and it predates permaculture by at least a couple of decades. What J.I. Rodale called the British system of organic gardening came into its own at about the same time the German philosopher and mystic Rudolf Steiner was popularizing his theory of biodynamicism. Both were rebellions against the accepted, highly toxic and destructive agricultural practices of the day. But while the Brits and Steiner were both inspired by rural forms of agriculture from around the world, all of which emphasized the use of every available form of organic matter, Steiner also veered deeply into symbolism, astrology, and astronomy. True biodynamics will bury animal parts, cattle horns, deer stomachs, stuffed with objects like crystals or manure, at precise times of the year in precise locations to later be dug up and made into homeopathic soil and compost preparations, following the exact formulas created by Steiner back in the 20s. Biodynamic agriculture is timed to the alignment of the planets and phases of the moon, and is accompanied by rituals like sitting naked on planting beds at precise times of night. Biodynamic tools contain copper plugs to help channel planetary energy into the soil and crops. And like all of the philosophies named by our listener, biodynamic agriculture is strictly organic, using no man-made chemicals and emphasizing the creation of naturally fertile soil. Now, how important are the rituals and other mystical aspects to being biodynamic? I suspect that depends greatly on the individual. I can say from my perspective, and that of the late Robert Rodale, that there is zero wrong with the biodynamic method. In fact, Bob once remarked that the biodynamics are as organic as we are and arguably more fun. Now, the biointensive method most emphasizes my style of organic growing. Build up the soil, keep it light and loose, and design systems that allow you to grow a lot of food in a small area. It's a version of, and very true to the components of, the French intensive style, a system that predates all the other name philosophies and that gave us the original concept of raised beds. Steiner incorporated elements of this French method in his biodynamic system, and then his student, Alan Chadwick, refined those elements, minus Steiner's mysticism, into a system he called biointensive. Chadwick introduced this new old concept to the United States, where the method was popularized by the great John Jevons and his group Ecology Action. Jevons' classic book, How to Grow More Vegetables and Fruits, Nuts, Berries, Grains, and Other Crops Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine, remains an incredibly useful treatise on intensive growing. Every serious organic gardener should read it. That brings us to permaculture, a philosophy based on the fashioning of systems, agricultural and social, that are naturally sustainable and that utilize a local area's resources to their utmost. Think of this as permanent culture, both in the concept of agriculture and human culture. Although it also lacks the mystical elements, permaculture does owe much of its core philosophy of thinking in large-scale cultural terms to Rudolf Steiner, who also helped found the Waldorf schools and Camp Hill communities, where residential living and agriculture are fully intertwined. Three systems of growing food without toxic chemicals and in ways that imitate and respect nature would seem to me to be much more alike than dissimilar, especially when you look back to their common influences and the cross-pollinations between them. Add my style, the Rodale method of organic growing, and Mel Bartholomew's intensive system of square-foot gardening, and we've got five philosophies that mesh like the fingers of a hand. Now, if you're tight on space or just want to grow a lot of good eating in a compact area, the bio-intensive, Rodale, square foot, and original French intensive methods should all work well for you. If you're leaning more towards building a long-term sustainable community of plants like the food forest our listener mentions, take a long look at permaculture. And if your instincts lead you towards building that community, or just plain gardening, in a way that incorporates symbolism, astronomy, and planetary energy, biodynamic might be what your spirit is craving. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we plucked thoughts and ideas from all of these philosophies. And we found that rather than clash against each other, they tended to naturally aggregate into common themes and goals. Read up on all of them. Take from each what you can use, and don't be afraid to create your own system. Well, that sure was some interesting information about my take on the different definitions of some interesting forms of agriculture now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hoogle my culture if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, including your location, at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you are, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website biodynamic. Mushroom Hunting Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is Al Underglass Banks. Our associate producer is Copper Plugged Brett Rader. I'm taking the second week of my first real break in 18 years, Mike McGrath. But I'll still be back to see you again next week. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.